Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks, a series of talks by scholars and graduate students on all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. If you'd like to join our network or find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter at @SSSNetwork and like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies. You can also visit our website at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.
So we're very lucky to have Masa Salamati here today, and she is a PhD candidate here at UNSW in film studies. Her thesis focuses on different aspects of transnational circulation of Iranian cinema since 1979. So her research covers various fields which are of all interest to us here at SSSN, including national cinemas, cultural policies, film festivals, and informal media circulation. So please make Masa welcome.
Thank you, Jessica, for the introduction. So the paper I'm presenting today is a part of the chapter that I'm still working on. So it will definitely benefit from the feedbacks that you're giving me after the presentation. It actually has two parts. The first section provides an insight on the informal film circulation in the context of my study, and then introduces an approach that enables me to explore more sophisticated aspects of this phenomenon in my context of study. And then based on this approach, the second section is a case study in which I look at a documentary called This Is Not a Film by Mojtaba Mirtahmas and Jafar Panahi. Complex transnational and local factors such as the advancement of technology or state control over film circulation have resulted in the emergence and expansion of alternative channels of film circulation all around the globe. Films are constantly removed from the predestined paths and are inserted into a wide range of informal channels to reach their audience. Media industries usually tend to advocate the suppression of such channels under established discourses of theft and deviance. The literature available on this topic, however, demonstrates that the institutional data provided by media agencies on the informal media circulation are problematic, as they align with the dominant logic of copyright within the capitalist world system. Such knowledge, as Yen Ang argues in her research on broadcasting industries, suppresses informal circulations and experiences. Therefore, instead of following the same pattern, the key task of media scholarship is to deconstruct the politics of knowledge that govern this relation. Ang's point is equally valid in the study of Iranian film industry. The institutional data is largely inadequate when it comes to understanding the dynamics of informal film circulation in the Iranian context. The transformation of the laws and policies in regard to informal media circulation and intellectual property since the 1979 revolution in Iran is an evidence of the constantly shifting alliances among the Iranian authorities, transnational legal regimes, piracy networks, and even consumers. In addition, pricing problems have some impact on the dynamics of the circulation of Iranian and non-Iranian films inside Iran. However, it has been mainly other factors like purification policies and controlling the access to certain films that shape the approaches towards informal film circulation in this context. Although such findings are important in order to understand the complexities of the circulations of films in Iran, the straightforward account of legality and pricing debates still overlook a wide range of practices that exist, but at the same time violate the established old order of film circulation. As this is evident in my research and other studies from various contexts, law enforcement has not played much a role in regulating the informal circulation practices. To be more concrete, there has been very little evidence that the enforcement efforts have had any impacts on the overall circulation of films in the pirate networks. Informal channels of film circulation constantly transform and have demonstrated a remarkable durability over the past few decades. Thus, it's important to move beyond the debates around legitimacy of such practices and study the more complex aspects of what becomes an ordinary practice among many people in Iran as well as all around the world. This paper, on the other hand, seeks to answer more sophisticated and important questions about informal circulation of Iranian cinema. How do the specific trajectories of certain films add another layer of meaning and political sensibility to them? How does the small world of informality lead to a massive change in access to certain cultural products? In order to answer these questions, I rely on different theoretical frameworks. At first level, this paper benefits from the emerging body of literature that places emphasis on the locally grounded analysis of various forms of film circulation. Eckstein and Schwartz, for example, draw attention to the necessity of a materially grounded pluriotopic critique that acknowledges the ways informal practices are always refracted by local histories and epistemologies. Yet acknowledging their ties to the logic of the capitalist world system. For these scholars, the universal approach to non-formal media circulation, similar to the universal post-Enlightenment narratives of history, had dramatic consequences for local formations of self and belonging. Local narratives of non-formal circulation, on the other hand, enables us to productively interrupt the totalizing thrusts of universal models and allows us to move beyond the Eurocentric imaginaries of theft, freedom, and resistance without denying their partial validity. In that sense, my analysis of the informal circulation of Iranian films challenges the universal assumptions that reduce these acts to the goods produced in the global center and consumed in the local peripheries. At another level, this paper draws on a classic anthropological perspective that places emphasis on tracing the social life of things. Arjun Upadhyay proposes a methodological framework in the study of the circulation of commodities in social life that emphasizes the things that are exchanged, emphasizes on the things that are exchanged rather than simply on the forms and functions of this exchange. Such framework, according to Upadhyay, makes it possible to argue that what creates the link between exchange and value is politics. According to Upadhyay, even if our own approach to things is conditioned necessarily by the view that things have no meaning apart from those that human transactions, attributions, and motivations endow with them, an anthropological problem is that this formal truth does not illuminate the concrete historical circulation of things. For that, we have to follow the things themselves, for their meanings are inscribed in their trajectories. End of quote. Igor Kopitov further expands Upadhyay's analysis in his article, Cultural Biography of Things. Kopitov questions the economist's approach to cultural commodities and proposes a culturally informed framework that looks at the objects as culturally instructed entities. He argues that for economists, cultural commodities, like any other commodities in general, are just things that circulate through the economic system and can be exchanged. However, from a cultural perspective, the production of commodities is also a cultural and cognitive process. That is, commodities must not only produce materially as things, but also culturally marked as being a certain kind of thing. Similar to ethnographic model that is based on the reasonable number of actual life histories, Kopitov suggests that in doing the biography of a thing, one would ask questions similar to those one asks about people. What sociologically are the biographical possibilities inherent in its status and in the period and culture, and how are these possibilities realized? Where does the thing come from and who made it? What are the recognized ages or periods in the thing's life? And what are cultural markers for them? How does the things used change when it ages? And what happens to it when it reaches to the end of its usefulness? Drawing on these conceptual and methodological frameworks, for the rest of this presentation, I studied the life and trajectory of This Is Not a Film by Mojtaba Mirtahmas and Jafar Panahi. This is the first of the three films Panahi released after he received a court order that he's banned from filmmaking for 20 years. So for those who are not familiar with Jafar Panahi, I'm just going to briefly explain Panahi's case. In July 2009, during the post-election upheavals in Iran, Panahi was arrested and questioned in Tehran Cemetery for attending an event upheld in memory of those who were killed during the protests. On 1st of March 2010, Panahi was arrested again, along with 17 members of his family and friends. This time, he was accused of making a film against the regime. He remained in custody for 80 days, during which he went on a 10-day hunger strike to protest against mistreatment of his family in prison. He was released on bail and attended court a few months later, where he was accused for assembly, collusion, and propagation against the regime. The appeal court upheld a 6-year prison sentence, and he was also banned from filmmaking, interviewing with any local or international media, and traveling overseas for 20 years. Even before his official ban from filmmaking, Panahi was unable to get a production permission from Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance to make a film for 5 years. Moreover, his last three films, The Circle, Crimson Gold, and Offside, did not get a screening approval. Therefore, they only became accessible in Iran through pirate networks. However, despite being banned from filmmaking, in May 2011, a copy of a documentary film titled This Is Not a Film was smuggled out of Iran and had a special screening at Cannes Film Festival. The film shows a day of Panahi's life while he's staying at home waiting for the result of his appeal. On January 11, 2013, the Berlin International Film Festival announced that Closed Curtain, directed by Kambuziya Pertovi and a screenplay by Jafar Panahi, has been selected for the competition section. Despite the reaction of Iranian authorities, who called the screening of Closed Curtain offensive and threatened that they would not attend European film market, the film was premiered and Panahi won the Silver Bear for the best screenplay. Finally, in February 2015, Panahi's third illegally produced film, Tehran Taxi, entered Berlinale and won the Golden Bear for the best film. Panahi's case drew attention of various groups and raised several debates and issues. On the one hand, some critics called his clandestine filmmaking a win for freedom of speech and acclaimed his films. Richard Brody of The New Yorker, for example, believed that the pressure of the circumstances transformed Panahi's art and he has turned from a classicist into a modernist, while at the same time transforming the very codes and tones of his frame-breaking aesthetics. On the other hand, he was accused that his films have been fused with the politics of his time. Hamid Dabashi, for example, argues that even though Panahi benefits from every potent technique for which he's known and praised, particularly his uncanny ability to thrive on that strange combination of fact and fantasy, his last film, Tehran Taxi, collapsed into political pamphleteering, and people who praise him are confused between political solidarities and their cinematic judgment. Whether we consider Panahi's peculiar reaction to the Iranian authorities an act of bravery, or we agree with Dabashi that political solidarity has dulled the cinematic judgment of those who appraise Panahi's latest works, the trajectory of his last three films are examples that help us unfold some of the more sophisticated aspects of film circulation at a transnational level. Meanwhile, it's important to notice that there is a little point in calling the production and circulation of Panahi's last three films subversive in general. Since the early days after his arrest, numerous major cinematic figures and film festivals have taken part in condemning his jail sentence and ban from filmmaking. These reactions, as Panahi's lawyer also highlighted in This Is Not a Film, were effective for his specific case. However, they did not lead to any major changes in the overall condition for another filmmakers in Iran. Moreover, such an approach does not pay attention to the politics of film festivals and their relation with the Iranian authorities that I highlighted before in my previous studies. From what I briefly described so far, it's clear that Panahi's case can be understood in relation to various elements and contexts that constantly problematize one another. One might attempt to describe and analyze all sets of relations with different contexts, but still that does not help us understanding all the aspects of this example. Here, I would like to point to another element that differentiates Panahi's latest three films from the rest. Since this is not a film, Panahi appears in all his films, constantly breaking the borders between fiction and reality. In that sense, I argue that the juxtaposition of different contextual elements, such as the circulatory dynamics of the films, the filmic text, and the constant presence of the filmmaker in his films, create what Michel Foucault calls a heterotopic space. In his 1967 lecture of Other Spaces, which was not published until 1984, Foucault draws attention to certain spaces that have curious property of being in relation with all other sites, but in such a way that as to suspect, neutralize, or invent the set of relations that they happen to designate, mirror, or reflect. At the same time, these spaces, which he calls heterotopias, literally means other spaces, are absolutely different from all the sites that they reflect or speak about. By juxtaposing and combining many spaces in one site, heterotopias problematize, receive knowledge, and destabilize the ground on which knowledge is built. Usually, there is a tendency to consider heterotopias as sites of resistance, yet heterotopias always remain connected to the dominant order. Thus, as heterotopias clash with dominant orders, they simultaneously produce new ways of knowing. In other words, heterotopia is a space where the telescoping of many spaces in one site leads to the intensification of knowledge and the revelation of the governing principles of its order. Panahi's This Is Not a Film creates a heterotopic space at different levels that I will unfold in the remaining of this section. In fact, we witness the very first traces of the emergence of this space in This Is Not a Film after Panahi's lawyer, Mrs. Gayrat, tells him on the phone that the appeal court probably would not drop the ban from filmmaking. After he hangs up, Panahi looks at Mojtaba Mirtahmas behind the camera and says, "I think I should remove the cast and throw it away." This bizarre statement, in fact, refers to a scene from The Mirror, where the 7-year-old protagonist of the film suddenly refuses to act. I'm going to show you this clip. So as you saw in this clip, Panahi explains the story while the scene is played on his TV. When Mina realizes that her mom did not show up to pick her up from school, she tries to find her home on her own. She gets on the bus, and as the bus goes, she realizes that she's going the wrong way. Eventually, Mina, the actress, feels humiliated and cannot take it anymore. She then removes the cast from her arm and shouts that the film is a lie. She wants to be herself, and she knows where her home is. So referring to this scene, Panahi identifies himself with Mina and says that he reviewed all shots and that he had filmed earlier and realized that everything is turning out to be a lie. That was the reason he contacted Mojtaba Mirtahmas, a documentary filmmaker who was planning a project about behind the scenes of the life of Iranian filmmakers not making a film, to film Panahi while he is reading his last screenplay. From this sequence onward, This Is Not a Film functions as a heterotopic space that reflects and connects different elements of Panahi's life as a filmmaker who cannot make a film. Panahi refers to scenes from his previous film. He reads parts of the screenplay that did not get an approval and explains about his court order and how it affects his life. All of this happens in the isolated space of Panahi's home. He never leaves this place, but brings in the shadows of all other spaces and elements that surround it. Even though the elements that are gathered in this space are real, what we see as a film is unreal, because the only way to perceive the real elements is in that specific order is to pass through the virtual space, which is Panahi's home, as shown in this film. So now I'm going to show another clip from this film. This is where Panahi mentions that now that he's not allowed to make a film, he's going to read the screenplay so his audience can get an image of the film. Then he actually insists that according to the court order, he's not banned from reading
screenplay or acting.
It
takes around 6 minutes, and it's a little bit boring, but it's meant to be boring. I'll explain why later.
No, it's not boring.
So the reason I said it's meant to be boring is, as you could see in the clip, Fanahi uses the film to intensify our knowledge of the ground on which the film is made. But at the same time, he also problematizes our received knowledge by revealing and dismantling the principles of the language of the film itself. Finally, we get back to the circulation of Panahi's last three films. The films never get screening approval inside Iran, but at the same time, Iranian authorities never had a serious public reaction to the controversies of their circulation in the international film festivals. Meanwhile, once the film found their way to the global market, they traveled through the regular channels of circulation. Although I must add that there was a rumor that the film, This Is Not a Film, was smuggled out of Iran in a USB, which was hidden inside the cake. I talked to the distributor of the film in Berlinale a couple of years ago, and she said it was just a rumor, but it became a strong advertising strategy, as I saw at the back of this cover. They mentioned that to make its Cannes premiere, This Is Not a Film was smuggled out of Iran on a USB stick hidden inside a cake. So otherwise, the film had its own regular channels of circulation. But what made the transnational circulation of the film controversial was in fact the result of the emergence of another historiotopic space in international film festivals. The circulation of the film actually intensified the knowledge again. So what I'm trying to suggest here is not that festivals are sites of resistance or subverting the order for countries such as Iran, but I mean the transnational movement of the film and the festivals made distancing and intensification of knowledge, which made the order legible. So the study of the trajectory of This Is Not a Film makes noticeable what remains obscure from the legal or institutional perspective. What is significant about the alternative channels of film circulation is not just about that there are channels for the circulation of the same material, but the ways the films are transformed and are sometimes culturally and politically redefined. Different channels of film circulation add different layers of politics and meanings to the films. Such meanings would have been irrelevant if the films were circulated through formal channels. In this sense, the so-called illegitimate copies are more than plain replication of the films. They are different objects that follow different stories and trajectories. Thanks.
Okay, if everyone's ready with their drinks, their wine and their cheese, we might get going. So just introduce myself for those who don't know me. My name is Melanie Robson. I'm a PhD student here in UNSW in SAM, and my area is more in film style. So thanks for that talk. It was really interesting. Firstly, I guess a sort of style question. I'm really interested in Panahi's appearances in his films, and you talked a little bit about that in your talk. But I'm thinking particularly of Closed Curtain, where it has the appearance of being a very relatively conventional sort of fiction film, and then somewhere maybe halfway along the film, he suddenly appears. And I'm interested in it because it's not just an appearance in the film like Hitchcock appears in his mm-hmm. film. It's an appearance that totally transforms or rethinks what the film is. It goes from perhaps having the appearance of a fiction film to the appearance of a documentary almost. I'm just wondering if you could talk a bit about what effect that has and maybe why he does that.
I think, the main thing that matters for my research, his appearance was a sort of trying to break the border between fiction and reality, and also emphasizing on the fact that he's not going to be
a filmmaker. He's not allowed to be a filmmaker, specifically in, you mentioned Closed Curtain. I'm just going to give another example, Tehran Taxi, where he appears as a taxi driver. He's himself, but also a taxi driver. And at some point, there is a burglar of like the pirate films who comes and he gives him a lift to deliver some films to another person. And then at that point, it's another moment of identification with those people who are in the margins, that he identifies with the pirate. And he's actually, the pirate offers him a job, that if you can become my partner, my business partner, we can make a fortune out of it in no time because people know you and they listen to you. And that's actually the way people have access to the films. So he brings in all these problems, like real problems of real life, as at the same time as he identifies himself with those people that we don't expect him to be identified with. So.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's actually almost a you can see a sort of development in his style from something like Closed Curtain to Tehran Taxi, where he's not just suddenly appearing in the film, but actually taking on a dual role and commenting on the issues of the film as well as being a part. Okay, so I just want to go back to the beginning where you were talking about the theoretical framework and the exchange of, you quoted the theorist whose name I've forgotten, I'm sorry, but you're talking about the exchange of things.
Oh, the social life.
Yes. And you're also talking about how Panahi has kind of made, since he's been making more subversive cinema, his success has been greater on the international field, particularly things like film festivals, and you mentioned some awards he's received. I'm just wondering why you think that is, and also what kind of, I really like that word exchange. Like, what kind of exchange do you think he's making on a cultural level on the international stage?
Well, Panahi's case is really interesting because it's not his success after the three films. He's basically one of the most successful. He had been one of the most successful Iranian filmmakers before that. I actually interviewed one of the managers of Farabi Foundation, which is a huge organization, cinematic organization, and they said that their bestseller film at transnational level is The White Balloon, which is directed by Panahi. So he still is a great asset for Iranian cinema. And that I believe, the reason I said it's not, what he does is not subversive in general, because he's relying on his, like how he is treated as a great prominent Iranian filmmaker. So,
I was really just asking what's exchanged at that international level between cultures, like.
Oh yes, so that's basically in a way that's politics. So the year that Tehran Taxi won Berlinale, well, I was there in the festival, and then that was actually the first time people ask him why he's making a film if he's banned from filmmaking, why there are no reactions. So I still see there are some politics going on. There are things that they're not easy to be spoken about in academia, especially with a very strong way. But at the same time, what I felt like it is really important because he's trying to do something in a way, and what he does is he temporarily he dismantles these orders. So he borrows the festivals to just question the order in the context that he's living in, and he kind of refuses to leave the country since then.
So were you saying that time you were in Berlin and they screened Tehran Taxi, that was the first time that people really started talking about overcoming censorship?
That's what his distributor told me. I had a chance to talk to her about an hour off the record about Panahi's film and on the record about other things. And then she was surprised at why no one asked about why is he making films when he released those two other films, and that's the first one that they're questioning
his filmmaking.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, so I guess continuing on with that sort of same theoretical framework, you also are talking about, you pose the question, how does the thing age? And I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about that in terms of Panahi's films as cultural products. Like, how has the meaning of, say, this is not a film, changed, either within Iran or outside of Iran?
I would say the way age affected Panahi's This Is Not a Film is it became more complicated as it as he released other films. Like, the it was just a film, and then another one came out, and then the next one came out, and then this one, he was an actor and it was a documentary, and he read the screenplay. The next one, he is a screenplay writer, and the other one, he's actually the director of the film. So he pushes the boundaries at the same time. So when you see the, so for that one, we could have said it's an accident, or he tried to see what are the reactions to the release of the film. And then after that, we are actually witnessing a phenomenon which is kind of unique even in the Iranian context. So when This Is Not a Film is put together with those reactions after that, and then the films that are made after, we don't know what he's going to do. He keeps filming the marginal, like poor areas of Tehran. He's really active in social media, but he hasn't released any films since Tehran Taxi. So we don't know what's going on after, because it's not that long since then. But even so far, we have seen it just becomes more complicated and more interesting at the same time.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose, what year did This Is Not a Film come out?
2011.
Yeah, so it's still those, and yeah, it's still so recent. I guess it's hard to see those trends, but that leads very nicely into my final question, which is, what do you think is the future of this? I mean, it seems like Panahi's kind of reinvented cinema for himself in the way he does cinema. And do you think that, like, how far do you think this can go, or do you think it's influenced, has it influenced other filmmakers in Iran to go in the same direction?
Well, what's going to happen next is a really good question, but the answer is I don't know.
Good.
And I really want to know what's going on next. But about how it affects other filmmakers, I would say it didn't really affect other filmmakers. Like, it didn't open up any space for other filmmakers. We are still, like, Iranian cinema still has the same strict policies, and then it has its own complicated relations with festivals and at the transnational level. And so it is important for them. The cinema has always been important for Iranian authorities after the revolution. And Panahi was certainly an asset, and that's the reason they are a little bit, they give him some space. He's not in jail. And he makes the films. But in general, no, it doesn't really affect other filmmakers, or at least I think it didn't really affect him.
No, and I think, sorry, I'm throwing to it. I mean, I fully agree with you, and I think in some ways, I love Panahi and I love his films, but in a sense, I feel that he has actually figured out how to work the system. Mm-hmm. In a different way to someone like Asghar Farhadi, who works the system. And Rasulov has done some kind of deal as well.
Yes, that's
right. That's kind of obvious from what the kind of output that we see from him. But they each—it's that each of these filmmakers seem to have some kind of very individual relationship and negotiation with the state, mm-hmm. about what those boundaries are. And I think a lot of it is probably kind of unspoken. There's a kind of a series of these sort of unspoken limits and rules that they don't expand. So I think that's what's happened. But then you see someone like, is it Kevan
Man.
Who's
Kevan Karimi, the Kurdish.
Kevan Karimi, who's filmed the drama screened at the Venice Film Festival when I was there last year. Sorry. Who's now, I think, still in jail. Very recently he was released, like a month ago. Who, because he doesn't have such a huge international profile, I mean, his film was screened not in the official selection, it was screened the week of the critics, right? And so he didn't have the same kind of public profile that someone like Panahi has, like, you know, some of the other filmmakers who've been, you know, arrested or whatever have. And so he doesn't have the cultural capital. And if, like Melanie's question about what are those exchange relations, first and foremost, it's about the degree of cultural capital that that filmmaker has both within Iran and outside of Iran that enables them to bypass many of the kind of legal systems in the country. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it seems, because when you first, I remember when I was first sort of learning about Panahi, I sort of thought, well, why can't they just do more to clamp down on his filmmaking? But of course, there's a certain amount of leeway made to allow him to make those films, I suppose.
And the state loves the international
company. Yeah.
So Mas has done some more research on this. Can I ask a question?
Yes, I was going to open it up to anyone.
So the question is to think about the circulation of his other films that had been banned in Iran and their wide, broad circulation internationally. And I believe that, I mean, not necessarily specifically for Panahi's films, but many other films, there's this kind of like grey area where a film is banned in Iran, but it circulates widely on the International Film Festival circuit, on DVD, Arthouse Cinema circuit. So what is the pathway for those kinds of films and what is their status in terms of the Iranian state?
So they usually find, this is a very rare case, like this doesn't happen regularly. It's only with prominent filmmakers that have this cultural capital, as Michelle says. So they are, so what is going on is festivals are not going to risk their reputation with Iranian authorities because they still have good relations. So They just risk on certain filmmakers, if that makes sense. And then Panahi is apparently one of them. And what they do is they find international distributors. So they won't work with Iranian distributors. And then the films find, and specifically in film festivals are really, they accept, there's a high chance that Iranian films get to festivals. So this is part of the policies of the festivals at the same time. So we are dealing with two different discourses which have their own complicated policies, and then they clash or interact, and that's what we are dealing with. This is what basically my thesis is, the transnational circulation of Iranian cinema. So we have to constantly monitor what's going on in the Iranian state and what's going on at the transnational level and in the film festivals, and then how are they going to interact and how their policies change and they push each other's boundaries. But at the same time, another thing which was really interesting was Panahi's distributor is someone who owns Celluloid Dreams based in Paris, and she actually started working with Farabi. Like when she started distributing, she started with Farabi. So she didn't, before Panahi, she didn't have any films that were outside of Farabi's. So Farabi circulated them locally, and then they had this lady who circulated the films internationally, basically in Europe. So yes, they are really close. And in a way, yeah, people in Farabi were totally aware of what was going on, and they were close friends. So that's really a paradox, which I cannot really understand or find an answer for why is it going on. It's just complicated and politics.
Does anyone else have a question they'd like to ask Masa?
Asking that, so has Celluloid Dreams always been his distributor? Is that right? Like when he films before, is he in terms of?
No, they're regional distributor for a few of their films. They had, I think The White Balloon, Farabi would never let that go. Farabi still has that because it's a great
it's really important for them. And then I think for those, I'm not really sure at the moment because they change their buy and sell. And also it's just regional, it's for Europe. So it doesn't mean that she is the distributor for like Australian or US circulation of the film. But I think there are only a couple more of his films. No, not all of his films.
Is it just in terms of like these later films were not really allowed to be made or were smuggled out or whatever compared
to the earlier ones? Yeah. So actually three other films he didn't get screening approval. After that, so it's like six films that they all had huge success out of Iran, outside of Iran, but then they didn't have a chance to screen inside the country.
And he told me that so the films prior to the ban, when I had a chat with him about it, I asked him, so you know they're banned in Iran, but you submit them for screening approval. So how is it that you get, and at this stage, these were 35mm prints, right? So he explained that he would always make sure that he had two, like, quality prints that could have docs made from them. And he would submit one to the authorities in full knowledge that they would probably not, approve it for screening at home. And he would have another one secreted away that could be readily smuggled out of the country so that it could make it to international festivals. So he already had this plan in mind as he was getting ready for the approval processes.
So Masa, you talk about the circulation of the film, but how does he earn money from these films if they're illegal?
Actually, Melanie and I were discussing it a while ago, and I saw in a website how much the gross for the films, that he has income from these films. And then, as I said, his previous film. So, as you saw in the film, he lives, he has a quiet,
lavish
life. And this is actually his home is in a very great area, like a very high level, rich area in Tehran.
Is it
Fereshteh Avenue? Yeah.
So the government turns a blind eye to the income stream.
Yes, I think it's not something that I'm specifically aware of, but I know that, for example, his sister was in, she's based in Europe, I don't know where exactly, and then they probably have these many reactions. Yes, because that's what I heard during Berlinale when they were discussing the money transfers, because back then Iran was under sanctions, so it was difficult in general to transfer money. So I think, but I definitely know that he has incomes.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Is he paying tax?
He'll never release his tax returns.
Any other questions?
Yes. Specifically the Berlinale, we were saying before that, was it this film where there was a dispute about the Iranian authorities saying that they wouldn't come to the festival?
If it's for close curtain, I guess, yeah.
So what's their relationship with the Iranian authorities? You're saying that
So this is what actually one of the Iran's IRB, so who is in charge of international relations of Iranian TV, he told me in the interview that the year before, like a couple of years before when they released Close Curtain, they said that they're not going to attend European film market because they screened Perde. And then the head of European film market told them, they actually wanted them back, and they asked them to stay in the market and to participate. And then they said that Berlinale has different policies from EFM, so it's just kind of apologizing. But yeah, I know they have really good relationships with, especially like the festivals and the Iranian government, especially with Farabi Foundation. Since the revolution, they invested on the films to be circulated outside Iran. So they wanted, actually there is a guy who is the founder of Farabi, and he's known as the
architect of Iranian cinema after the revolution, because he's an architect and then he's in cinema, so that's the reason there. So I'm calling
him. All these Iranians have lives.
So he is the architect of Iranian cinema, and he told me that when they were in Europe to find films to screen in Iranian cinemas, they wanted it to be, he was talking to a friend, and then they said, in 10 years, we have to have Iranian films screened in festivals, and then they have to be taught in Western universities, and we can see that it's happening.
You're
oh my god, I fell for that trick.
Yeah.
Where's my kickback?
You're saying earlier that Iranian films have a high chance of making it into international film festivals. Is that because the promoters of those films, you know, promote them heavily and push them, or is it because the film festivals themselves want Iranian films?
It's actually festivals' policies, and then I discussed with Michelle, and she said it happened even before the revolution with Shahid Salas's films. When the with festivals, they want to have diverse range of films from different countries, and then once they know that the country, there is a chance that the country has good films, so, and they know the connections, they know the distributors, so there is a chance, for example, there's more chance for Iranian films to go there compared to other countries in the region which don't have that sort of acclaimed cinema. So with the screening in the festivals, if a film is from Europe, I'm talking about European festivals, yeah, there is a little chance for them to get them because it's highly competitive, but there is a chance for Iran as well as other countries to get to the festival. But with the screening, like the general screening of the films, European films have subsidies, so there is a chance for them to get screenings in European cinemas than Iranian films.
Hmm.
And to add to that, like there's actually a long history of where films that are co-produced between Iran and somewhere else have a greater chance of going into the festivals through their Iranian heritage. And there's a recent example of that, and that's the UK film. What was the horror film that was at the Sydney Film Festival? Under the Shadows?
Yes, Under the Shadows.
Yeah. So it was ostensibly a UK film by an Iranian, a filmmaker with an Iranian background. But I noticed that in all the publicity, it said that it was a UK-Iranian co-production. I was never able to actually identify any specific kind of Iranian contribution aside from the filmmaker's background in that. And so I'm assuming that there's a kind of a canny utilization of the rules of festivals that still are very nation-based in getting a film like that into a festival based on it being a Iranian film. But then ironically, it was submitted by Britain as the British entry for Best Foreign Film. So, you know, these you talk about the social life of films, and I think there's kind of a interesting kind of national political life of films as well.
Yep. And I seem to remember at that festival there was a great part of the promotion of it was that it's, you know, Iranian made in Iran with all Iranian actors. Yeah. And I think
the guy who introduced it told a lie. He said it was made in Iran. It wasn't made in Iran. It was like made in somewhere else.
Somewhere
in the Middle East. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's almost part
Jordan,
of the
Jordan.
Yeah. They almost use Iran as that sort of promotional thing. There's a question up the back earlier.
Did you have forgot one? About it, to be honest.
Oh, sorry. any other questions?
Yeah, I think it's because of this idea of a new wave as well.
They're riding a really long new wave, considering it really began in the, let's say, the late 50s. Most people say early 60s, but I've discovered examples from the mid-50s. Yeah. It's a long tail.
It's a long tail.
Big wave.
New Iranian new wave.
Yeah, yeah, totally. That's a really good point.
And were these co-produced as well, these ones? Or these three that you've been talking about?
They're all filmed and produced in Iran. I think there is a producer for a couple. I think they are founded. They have co-productions, Panahi and another company. So yeah.
They have very minimal credits. So, mm-hmm.
So another answer to how he's earning money.
I mean, they don't look very expensive.
So. No, they're really low budget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. They probably cost more than they.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But one really interesting point about this, and so Melanie asked a question about how these films age, and what's really interesting for Panahi as an auteur is to actually look at how every next film, there's some kind of, it asks us to retrospectively look at his earlier films. And, you know, Taxi is kind of like the ultimate apotheosis of that because it bears within it traces of all the films that he'd made before, like The Old Ladies with the Goldfish and the little girl who he picks up late from school. And they're all there. There's a comment about the thief that's in the taxi. It relates to Crimson Gold. They're all there. They're all there. But you also mentioned the filming in poor areas, but with Tehran Taxi, we actually go to quite a cross-section of the socioeconomic area of Tehran because we have the initial trajectory down in Bali Asra, right?
It's
and then the clients for the pirate guys in the northern suburbs.
They're in northwestern suburbs, so they're fairly upper middle class to upper middle. Not the places, not similar to where he lives actually.
Spring, right? Which is
northwest again.
Northwest,
yes. So they're not like that rich area. So what I referred to was the post that he put on Instagram. He goes to at night to poor area. You have to follow
him. Is he a regular poster?
He puts things constantly. He puts videos there. He's quite active. He's active socially. He's very active socially and politically in Iran. He goes to different places, appears. He shows up everywhere.
And that's the other myth that the Western media perpetrate, is that he's under...
He's not.
Just not true.
Another question is, well, were you saying before that as well, like, that these films sort of continue to be celebrated even though aesthetically they're very strong? Is that what you... I'm sorry, I didn't quite...
Dabashi's criticism.
Yes, that was one of the criticisms.
About that idea. Obviously, they're very different to The Circle or something like that.
Mm.
But, yeah, are you saying that they can... So that's one of the criticisms of them.
Yes, that was one of their opinions.
Who he is and the political circumstances and his pride.
He actually wrote that in an article. The title was The Death of Iranian Cinema, or Is the Iranian Cinema Dead? Something like that. It was really intense. Sorry?
What's your view on that?
I don't agree with him that it's like we have to understand what is Iranian cinema in general. So in a way, I agree with the death of Iranian cinema in a very certain way, not in the way that he means. But as the paper I presented actually is a way that I would say it's not an act of freedom or a way of resistance. But at the same time, it's not just some sort of nonsense movie that he released based on his, just relying on his past works and that the fact that he's well known outside Iran. So, no, there's something more complicated going on.
So, really sophisticated cinematic schema that's going on in all of those films. Even This Is Not a Film, which looks to be very improvised and simplistic and apparently filmed over one day, but it filmed it over about 4 days. So they're philosophically and conceptually, they're incredibly dense and rich.
So he breaks the language. So the more I look at the film, the more I realize that it looks like a documentary. It was released as a documentary, but in fact, it's not in
fiction.
It is made like it's. He thought about it really well. It's not just randomly calling someone and offering that I'm going to just film me because I'm here. I'm not making a film, and you are going to make a film about people who are not making a film. So come here and film me and make a film. So this is not what's going on. And even from their the way they discuss things, you know that it's not the way that people usually talk to each other, especially with the lawyer. The lawyer is really cautious, and she definitely has known that he's going to call him and he's going to record what she's telling. So that was a feeling that I got. Or he's talking to Rakhshan Banyetamot, who is another prominent filmmaker, and you can see that something's going on, like they're all planned. Even though you won't get it with subtitles, that's one of the reasons that he's going to release the film for non-Iranian audience. He knows that it's not going to be screened in Iran.
Can I ask, is his lawyer the same lawyer who comes into the car with the roses?
No, that's Nasrin Sotoudeh. That's not his lawyer, but that's another lawyer who was arrested for a long time and she went.
Okay, well, if there are no further questions, we will wrap it up there. Thank you, Masa. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork, like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies, and visit us at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.